Some people might say coffee doesn't need chocolate, but you're not some people. You're a dreamer. You see the possibilities of chocolate and caramel flavors swirling together with cold brew, topped with velvety chocolate cold foam and cocoa caramel crumbles. That imagination can only be rewarded with Dunkin's new caramel chocolate cold brew. It's a cold brew dream come true. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.
Inspiring interviews with today's top landlords.
This is the Rental Income Podcast.
And now, Dan Lane.
My guest on the podcast today has an incredible story. He wanted to start buying rental properties, but the only money he had was inside of his 401k. So he decided to close the 401k down, pay the taxes, pay the penalties, and use that money to start buying rental properties. A lot of people might think that's kind of risky, and I think I agree with them. It's a good thing he didn't know me back then, because I may have tried to talk him out of it. It's a good thing I didn't, because that initial investment is worth millions of dollars now. He's got an incredible portfolio and a great story. So on the show today, we're going to find out exactly how he built his portfolio. Joining us on the show today from Sacramento is He-Man Chan. We'll take a really quick break. We'll thank our sponsors. We'll come right back and we'll meet He-Man. When I'm doing research to buy a new rental property, there's a lot of different websites, apps, and then a spreadsheet that I use to do my analysis. It's really kind of a convoluted process. Well, there's a much easier way. There's an app called Ask Rick. That's R-I-C for Rental Income Calculator. Ask Rick makes it really easy to find and analyze rental properties. You can see all the properties for sale in an area. If something looks good, you can press one button. It'll analyze the property for you. It'll figure out the rent amount. It'll figure out your mortgage payment, all your expenses, and give you your cash flow. If you're ready to move forward, you can make an offer right there on the app, or you can send the information over to your realtor to do some more investigation into the property. You can try it out for free right now. Just search for Ask Rick. That's R-I-C, Ask Rick in the App Store, or go to justaskrick.com. That's justaskrick.com. The team at Just Ask Rick is constantly working on making the app better. They just released an update to make the map load faster, and you can now schedule a tour by sending a calendar invite right in the app. If you tried it out before, you might want to give it another shot. If you haven't tried it yet, start your free trial today at justaskrick.com. The first step in buying a rental property is to get pre-qualified. And I would suggest you work with a lender that specializes in working with investors, because the last thing you want to have happen is to get to closing and find out the money's not there and you can't close. The lender that I recommend is Chaley Ridge from Ridge Lending Group. She's a nationwide lender, and she'll pre-qualify you for free if you mention Rental Income Podcast. Find out more today. Contact Chaley at ridgelendinggroup.com. That's R-I-D-G-E, lendinggroup.com. NMLS 42056. Why don't we start off by talking about what your portfolio looks like today, and then we'll kind of take a step back and figure out how you got there.
Yeah, so right now I've got 12 properties total that we have currently, single family homes mostly. There's a strategy behind it, but that's essentially where we're at.
Awesome. And your properties are nicer properties, right? They're in good neighborhoods.
Yeah, absolutely. So we actively went out and decided to change our entire portfolio from what we needed to do initially to get into the market, to where we wanted to be, 5-6 years from then. And now we've got a vision of, hey, where we want to be 5-6 years from now. So we went out and actively seeked, minimum requirement that we set was, hey, it had to be a 3-bedroom, 2-bath single family home and in a nice area, because it just makes things easier. Rents are higher, less callbacks for any kind of repair work. And overall, big picture, we thought that would be a better strategy for us from where we were initially.
Let's go back to the very beginning. So when you first wanted to start buying rentals, you didn't have a lot of money, but you had some money in your 401k. To be honest, like, the idea of cashing in the 401k sounds risky to me. But for you, it actually worked out beautifully. So like, why did you do that? Like, why did you cash in your 401k versus trying to find the money somewhere else?
You know, I've always, I'm a spender. so I'm not very adamant, you know, very good about actually saving money aside and saying, okay, I'm going to save for the next 10 years or 5 years and have enough money to do this. So the way I used to force myself to save was I would always make sure I got taxed the highest amount that I could out of my wages. And also I tucked away a bunch of money in 401k. And so at the end of every year, I would get a big tax return back. And it forced me to live within less means. And every time I got a raise, I bumped up my 401k to maximize it. And I've just always been wired to, and anybody that knows me knows that I've been wired to be one of those guys that I might wake up the next morning and be like, all right, I'm going to go buy a house and then I'll go buy a house. Or I'm going to go buy a car. And it might just be a decision that was made, you know, that morning. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of move forward because that's just the way I'm wired.
Right.
I think
okay.
The 401k thing kind of was the same thing. I was like, all right, I think there's some opportunity with economy doing what it's doing. I'm going to cash it out. I'm going to go ahead first and just, I'm going to keep swimming. I'm not sinking.
Now, the downside to cashing in your 401k is you've got to pay the taxes on the money you've taken out. And then also a 10% penalty if you're under retirement age. Did you find a way around that or did you have to pay those taxes and the penalty?
I did have to pay the penalty and the taxes on it.
Okay.
There is really no way around it.
Okay.
But that was part of the decision was like, all right, fine. You know, the net that we got that I pulled out was after the taxes was what I ended up with. But again, it was just another calculated risk of, you know, it's boring to watch for me at least stock just sit there and watch the fluctuations happen because there's no excitement in it.
Exactly. Yeah. Real estate, you know, it's like, it's very profitable. It's very lucrative, but it is a lot more fun than the stock market. So I'm happy to hear you say that. So let's talk some numbers. So how much did you cash out of your 401k?
The net of it at the end of getting a check, actually, after the penalties and everything else, I pulled $80,000.
Okay. And just to flash forward to today, that $80,000, what have you turned that into?
About $2.9 million.
$2.9 million?
Yeah.
That is absolutely incredible. Now, I just pulled up a calculator here to see how much that 80 grand would have been if you had kept that in the stock market. And it looks like it's $237,000 if you hadn't have done anything versus where you are today. So congratulations. That is really awesome. Now, how did you do that? Like, was that your down payment to buy some properties or did you buy with cash? Like, how did you go about actually buying the rental properties?
So the opportunity kind of presented itself. We had a friend at the time that was going to the courthouse and buying and doing flips. And he was working for a gentleman that was flipping, you know, I don't know, 300 homes a year. And there are some properties that they wouldn't go after, but the research was already done on them. These are 3-bedroom, 1-bath condos for $20,000, $25,000, where we'd go in. We'd buy these with cash. We own them outright, and we ended up holding on to the ones that were the most desirable. Even in that, you know, even in buying homes in non-desirable areas, there's still ones that bubble up to the top. We're like, well, I'm going to hold on to this one long term. I'm going to go ahead and flip this one. Mm-hmm. So we kind of got in that way and bought, you know, our first property. I mean, literally the day after I gave him the check, the next day we bought a property and for $55,000, it was a 3-bedroom, 2-bath place. And a month later, we sold it for about $100,000 more. And wow. So all of a sudden, it kind of started amplifying the amount of equity that we had available to actually buy and hold stuff. And we did that for a few years. And that's what really kind of helped.
Okay. So you started off flipping and then that turned into buy and hold?
Yeah. And the flip was only like 3-4 homes that we did.
Okay.
And it was just if it seemed like the right one would be a good flip, then we would just flip that and build up our equity, maybe buy two the next time, hold on to one, and then flip the next one. But you know, I don't think we did many, not as many as most people do when they're doing flips. So I mean, like I said, he was working for a gentleman that was flipping, you know, 300 plus a year.
Yeah. And so you had a couple of partners that you were working with?
Yeah. So a couple of my friends that we had gotten together, we put it together. So, and it put the funds together. And so one of them was already working doing flips. The other one was in finance. And I just always have been the one that brings people together to say, okay, hey, let's do this. And
right.
What do we got to lose?
Did you guys all put in the same amount of money?
Yes.
Okay. So you had three guys putting in 80 grand a piece. So you had $240,000 cash to work with.
Yep.
After you did a couple of flips, what did you, like, how much capital were you working with when you started to buy properties that you were going to hold?
It added another $150,000 to the
market. Okay. Okay. Awesome. All right. So you've got like about $400,000 now, and that's when you started buying rentals to hold?
Yeah.
So you were buying cheaper properties. Were they in like a rougher neighborhood, or what was the neighborhood
absolutely.
Like? Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Rough is probably the right way to explain it.
Okay.
But, you know, I grew up in a rough neighborhood when I was younger. So for
okay.
me, you know, it was like, yeah, it's a rough neighborhood, but it gets you into the type of tenants where, I mean, there's really no purpose of even pulling a credit report. I mean, you're essentially just looking for if they've got evictions in the past, and that's your deciding factor, because a lot of them do have government assistance, and there were some Section 8 ones, and you kind of roll the dice and realize that, okay, yeah, we're going to have some bad apples here, but let me see if I can be a better judge of character by meeting the people.
Yeah.
And seeing what they're about, and, you know, just taking a peek inside their car, because the way the people treat the inside of their car is also the way they're going to treat the inside of your
right. home. So did that work? Like, did you find good tenants, or did you constantly have a lot of turnover and a lot of evictions?
It wasn't constant. I mean, in the, I don't know, 15, 20 years I've been doing this, maybe I've had to evict 7, 8 people.
Okay.
What I got really good at doing is, because we manage our own properties, is if you're running a business, you can't get into the gray area where you're like, oh yeah, rent's due on the first, but okay, hey, it's the 10th, it's okay. Because as soon as you do that, it just snowballs. So we got really good at, hey, if rent wasn't in on the date that it was due, 3-day notice on the door immediately, and we start the process, no questions asked.
Right. Yeah,
because,
that's smart.
Oh, you know, because that's the biggest mistake I think most, landlords make, is they kind of let it slide or take partial payment. And the instant you open that door, legally, it doesn't work for evictions.
Right.
Because you've led them to believe that, oh, partial payment is okay. And so that's kind of what made it, we just got better at it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's really true, because when you've trained your tenant that it's okay to pay late, they're never going to prioritize the rent. Like if they have the rent due and their cell phone bill, they're always going to pay the cell phone because they know that you're going to be flexible.
Yeah. You're really training them to do the opposite.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, hey, listen, like, hey, you know, when it comes to paying rent, like, there is no flexibility.
Exactly. Yep. All right, so you had those properties in the lower end neighborhood, and then at some point you shifted because your properties today are in nicer neighborhoods. So, like, why did you shift why did you change your strategy?
It was just, sometimes your gut just tells you to do it, and I do a lot of stuff by gut. I mean, based on, you know, what I told you about my 401k, withdrawing money out of there, and it was just, all right, hey, we bought these at an opportune time. The properties have paid for themselves 10 times over. They're worth, 6-7 times more than what we paid for them. Let's cash those out and get into nicer neighborhoods. One of the bigger reasons was, when you have the certain types of properties that you have, you're just going to get a lot of calls on. And it might have to do with the way the tenant treats your property, but it's your problem now. And we just wanted to get away from that because, aside from doing the rental stuff, both me and my other business partner, we both have a full-time job. And so we wanted something that was going to take less of our effort. And then on the turnaround, when finding new tenants and whatnot, like, it just wanted to stop going to those type of neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. Six or seven.
So we consciously made an effort to say, okay, hey, wait a minute. If we can get the same rate of return on nicer properties, why wouldn't we do that?
Right. So you had 6 or 7 times appreciation on those initial properties you bought?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Absolutely.
So, like,
the properties paid for themselves.
Give me an example. Like, what did you buy the property for, like, for one of your rentals, and then what did you sell it for?
So we bought a single family home, 3-bedroom, 1-bath for $40,000. We held on to it for about 6 years. Their rent was $1,200 a month. I mean, simple math on the $1,200 a month in a given year, even after repairs and stuff, you're making $12,000.
Right.
Right. Because right. there's no mortgage.
Right.
All you're paying is insurance and you're paying your taxes. So if you take that over a 5-year span or 6-year span, that's $70,000 right there.
Right.
That you got back for that property that you initially bought for 40. And then at the end of it, we were able to sell for, you know, about $250,000,
$260,000. Now, that is really incredible. Did you know that the market was going to appreciate like that? Because you were buying in 2008, which looking back on it, it was the bottom of the market. But did you realize that you were buying at the bottom of the market when you bought those properties?
No, but we knew there were good deals and it pencils out.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, if you're buying something all cash, it's always going to pencil out because right. there's no mortgage. So it was more of generating the cash flow. Now, you know, imagine having 8 of these, 9 of these, 10 of these.
Yeah.
Now the cash flow is snowballing and it allowed us to go ahead and get into the single family market as well without taking huge mortgages, with putting, you know, almost 50% down and then letting that snowball again to where systematically we went through and started paying off the single family ones.
Right.
And so that's what really catapulted the portfolio is once it starts to snowball, then your cash flow is there, you've got more money in the bank and you're able to do more opportunities.
Yeah. Yeah, with those initial deals, even if they had never appreciated, they would have been home runs, you know, just with your cash flow that you were getting with. But that appreciation is the icing on the cake. I mean, that is really awesome. So when you sold those properties, did you do a 1031 exchange to avoid paying the taxes or did you just pay the taxes on it?
I mean, it's inevitable the taxes are always going to go up. So all you're doing is kicking the can down the road. You're eventually right. going to get taxed. And I just come from a different mindset. Yeah, you know, it gives you more equity to work with, but I just don't like that looming. All right, there's going to be a big tax bill that happens right. down the road.
Right. Yeah, it is hanging over your head. Yeah.
Yeah, so, especially if you're going to get into your higher earning income years, then it's actually worse for you.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's true. Okay. So you sold those initial properties. Did you sell them all? Did you decide, okay, we're going to move into a nicer area? Like, let's sell all these properties, or did you do them?
We did two at a time.
Two at a time.
So we sat down and we said, all right, hey, let's do this. Let's sell two at a time and two a year. That's what we said we would do.
Okay. Okay.
And slowly start shifting over. It was just a progression of it because that also let us catch another wave because when most people are like, oh, you know, property's already appreciated. You can't get any, you know, the economy's going to get worse and things aren't going to get better. Oh, we were still buying. But when you spread it out over a, you know, 6-year or 8-year program, you're going to hit the highs and lows, just like how people deal with stock markets.
Right. Yep. Just kind of dollar cost averaging into the new properties.
Yeah.
Now, when you're moving to a nicer area, you're going to get a lower return on your properties, more than likely. I'm sure that those crazy returns you were getting on your lower end properties, you weren't able to get those returns on your higher end properties. Well, was that hard to swallow that you were going to be getting less cash flow or a smaller return on your money?
Not at all, because we always approached it as, hey, if we've got the cash, when we buy the next property, we're going to make sure we put enough down payment down to avoid PMI and to let it cash flow still.
Okay.
So we didn't make it so slim that it didn't still feel like it was cash flowing. Yeah, it was less, but we had to step back and look at the bigger vision that we had, which was, all right, that's fine. It's less. Now we're holding on to nicer real estate that the equity is being built up onto it. And we knew that it's not going to take us 30 years to pay those off. Yeah. We're going to do it in a much shorter time. So then we picked the ones that we were going to pay off faster and kind of just let that snowball. And, you know, similar to what they tell you and any finance class or whatnot is, hey, pay off the one that's got the biggest interest first, you know, rate on it and work your, and once you're done paying that off, double the payment on the next one.
Mm-hmm. So that's what you're doing now. Like you're focusing on paying all these mortgages off for your current properties?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Awesome. So then what's the plan? Like, so you want to get everything 100% free and clear? Is that your long-term goal?
Yeah, and I think we should be, you know, with the current portfolio that we kind of got it up to with the single family homes, we should be able to do that in the next 4 or 5 years. And then we'll be back at where we were originally with all the low income properties, but now we got properties that are worth, you know, $500,000 each.
Right.
And are more marketable if we want to start offloading them.
Well, yeah. There's a couple of things that you're doing with your management that I think are really smart. I think you're being really efficient with it. And I want to hit on these real quick. The first thing is you kind of touched on this, is you virtually have no vacancy with your rental properties. How have you done that?
Yeah, and that's actually pretty accurate. Most people don't believe it. It just comes down to getting better at managing what's going on, right? So a lot of people wait till after a tenant's moved out before they start marketing the property. Well, there in itself, you lose a month and you can potentially lose 2 months, because from the time a tenant finds your property and likes it and applies and you approve them, well, they're going to go give their notice as well. So then you've lost another 30 days where that person can't move in. So what I always do is, you know, all my leases with my tenants are written in a way where, hey, similar to when they came in, you know, they're going to assist in showing the property while they're still there and completing their tenancy. And so what it does is it creates that overlap and it makes it to where I can literally get somebody in the door within a day or two of one tenant moving out. And so we've strategically done that, and that's worked. I mean, I have properties where maybe I've had 5 different tenants over the last 10 years, and I literally have not lost one day of rent.
That is incredible. The other thing that you're doing, which I think is really cool, is when you do a rent increase, a lot of times you're asking the tenant, what do you think is a good rent increase? Walk me through how that works.
And that was kind of a strategy that I've used with the tenants is, you know, most of them, obviously everybody wants to keep the rent the same, and that's not feasible because there's, you know, cost of living adjustments and things just become more expensive. So usually I'll start off, you know, I'll have this conversation 2 months before their lease is up to make sure they're going to sign another 1-year lease and say, okay, hey, you know, rent, you know, your lease is coming up for renewal. You know, what do you think is there's some expenses that are getting up there. But what do you think the appropriate increase for rent should be? And I just kind of throw it out there to start the conversation. And if they come back with something that seems palatable for me, because I already know what I want in my mind, if it comes back more palatable for me, I'm like, okay, yeah, you know what? Let's do it. Or if they come back with something that's just doesn't make sense, then I go through the process of saying, all right, well, here's what I was thinking and here's why.
Right.
And more out of, you know, 9 out of 10 times, they'll understand where I'm coming from and will pay that amount that would be the increase, but it makes them a part of the process, and you get more buy-in from somebody if you make them part of the process versus just throwing something their way and saying, hey, here's a letter. And it's an personal when you do that, we just shoot off a letter to somebody saying, hey, starting this day, the rent's going to go up by this much.
Have you ever had a tenant
got buy-in? Go ahead.
Have you ever had a tenant come in higher than what you were thinking you were going to increase it?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's great.
Where, you know, in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, well, this tenant's been with me for 4 years. Never called me about any issues. I've inspected the property. Looks great. They take care of it. Man, I'd keep them here for another 3 years at the same rate.
Right.
And they come back and they're like, okay, you know, we think this is fair. And it's like, great. Awesome.
That's great.
Because a lot of people don't realize when you have a good tenant, the $100 more that you make a month on that tenant is only $1,200 a year. Now, if you lose a good tenant and you get a crappy one, that can cost you thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. So I always, you know, I always advise even people that ask me for my advice on rentals, like, don't chase $50, don't chase $100. Get the right tenant. That'll make your life a lot easier. And then systematically do little increases. And so you still feel like, hey, you're able to get your rents increased. But that's always been the approach that I've taken, and it's worked well for me.
He-Man's next step in building out his rental portfolio is to buy smaller apartment buildings in the Sacramento area. If you know of anything for sale or anything coming up and you want to get in touch with He-Man, just shoot me an email, dan@rentalincomepodcast.com, and I will get you guys in touch. I'd like to thank today's sponsor for making this episode possible. It's Chaley Ridge from Ridge Lending Group. If you are looking to buy a rental property, whether you're just getting started or you want to add to your portfolio, the lender that I recommend is Chaley Ridge. She's a nationwide lender, and she specializes in helping investors buy rental properties. She has a ton of different loan programs, and she can get you into a loan that will fit you and your unique situation and whatever goals you're trying to accomplish with your rental portfolio. If you want to find out more or set up a time to talk to Chaley personally, just go to ridgelendinggroup.com. That's RIDGE, lendinggroup.com. If you mention Rental Income Podcast, she will waive all the pre-qualification fees. NMLS 42056. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast today. If this is your first time here, make sure you subscribe. We have new interviews every single Tuesday. And if you subscribe, you'll get notified as soon as they come out. My name is Dan Lane, and this has been the Rental Income Podcast.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.